Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. It was the largest battle west of the Mississippi, involving 32,000 Confederate and Northern troops, and it's been ranked as one of the 25 top Civil War battles anywhere. That confrontation happened right here in Kansas City. It's known as the Battle of Westport. The 150th anniversary of the battle is on tap for October, and new efforts are underway to preserve big chunks of the battlefield and commemorate what some call the most dramatic event in Kansas City history. With us today to talk about the Battle of Westport is Daniel Smith. He's an attorney at Anchor Holtz and Smith. He's chairman of the Minette Battle of Westport Fund, devoted to preserving the battlefield. And Dan, so nice to have you. Welcome to Up to Date.
My pleasure, Steve. I really appreciate the opportunity to meet with you. And on behalf of the Minette Fund and the Civil War Roundtable of Kansas City, we are just delighted to be able to talk with you.
That's great. Well, the Battle of Westport is sometimes called the Gettysburg of the West. Why?
Well, this kind of originated at the turn of the last century. In 1905, there was a book published here by, a Presbyterian minister who was a aficionado of guns, actually, rifles. And he, as a young graduate of Princeton, was very involved in this battle. And he made the analogy that this was like Gettysburg in the sense that it was a three-day battle. And it determined that the federal forces or Union forces were going to be victorious. And it saved, in this instance, Missouri secured it for the Union. Obviously, Pennsylvania didn't fall to the Confederates.
Yeah. Not as many people died here, obviously, as in Gettysburg. Gettysburg was, what, 50,000?
Absolutely. The casualty rates at Gettysburg are far greater than here at Kansas City, but by the same token, Westport was a very intense and at times very bloody affair.
I think like 1,500 or so died on each side, roughly?
That's correct. Roughly the estimate these days are the casualties are about 3,000 overall.
You know, Dan, why did these armies, I mean, the one from the north and then the Confederate forces, obviously wind up here in Kansas City? Because in those days, we were the westernmost edge of the U.S.
The reason has to do more with politics than military strategy, quite frankly. Sterling Price was the Confederate the governor of Missouri, and became a Confederate general rather belatedly. He was actually a Douglas Democrat and did not favor secession. Mm-hmm. Missouri had voted against secession 99-1 in the conference or Congress that preceded that in March of 1861. It was only after some disputes with the federal authorities in St. Louis that Sterling Price became a Confederate. And he did it at some personal risk to himself, because obviously they would lose their ability to own land as rebels. And he came here to Kansas City because he had read a newspaper article in the summer of 1864 from St. Louis that said people over in Platte County had basically jumped ship from the local militia, and it's somewhat similar to what we see in Iraq or Afghanistan, and gone over to the other side. Huh. And so it was Price's intent or assumption that if he were to show the flag here in Kansas City or Missouri broadly, that everyone would rally to his cause. And that was the reason why he went so far as to get here to Kansas City, rather than turning and going south through Lexington as he had 3 years earlier after the Battle of Lexington.
Now, in the weeks preceding this battle, these armies were a little bit on the move, right? Give us a sense of how they convened here.
Well, the actual Missouri campaign, or the Price's Raid, as more popularly called, it's the longest expedition of the war. It covered 1,400 miles, and it started in southwest Arkansas, which was then the Confederate capital, and it had moved from there. Price gathered his forces, because most of them had been paroled following the fall of Vicksburg, because they had fought there and been captured and paroled. And they started upwards and went northeast through Arkansas into southeast Missouri.
These Confederates were fighting for a second time. They'd already been captured once at Vicksburg.
Absolutely.
A huge pivotal battle occurred roughly the same time as Gettysburg. The North is ascendant here, and then there's obviously this fight over Missouri and what's going to happen here.
Yeah. Right, because Price still thought that if he could show enough, he'd get enough men here and enough troops and show the flag, that the popular sentiment of Missouri would be to throw off the shackles of federal oppression. And so the idea was to come into southeast Missouri, strike up that way and hopefully strike St. Louis and divert federal forces that were headed for Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of fell apart at the Battle of Pilot Knob or Fort Davidson in the end of September. But imagine that we have a Confederate army that is at large in the state of Missouri from the end of September, about 27th September, until this battle, which happens on the 21st, 22nd, and 23rd of October, roughly a month. And during that period of time, they occupy space. They go to the Little Dixie area, particularly in Saline County and across the way.
Down where, in the Boot Heel you're talking
no,
about.
No, we're talking about in central Missouri.
Missouri, okay.
We're talking about Marshall, Glasgow,
okay. Yeah, right.
And all of that. And so these men also were largely Teamsters. The people around Kansas City, you could think of it as yellow freight on steroids here in Kansas City. Most of the men that were in the Confederate Army had done something with either the Santa Fe trade or some other kind of Teamster activity out of here. So they knew their way around, and they knew the logistics, and that's what made them a mobile force. But they weren't arrayed in the sense that people think of either Morgan or Hunt. They were more inclined to try to occupy space and show that, you know, the feds didn't have everything, that they instead had some power to stay here. But unfortunately for Price, the people were so demoralized by this point in time that he never got the rally to the flag sort of effect that he was hoping for.
Uh-huh. We're talking about the Battle of Westport. Today it's been ranked as one of the 25 top Civil War battles anywhere. We're approaching the 150th anniversary of this battle. We're visiting with Dan Smith, who's an attorney. He's chairman of the Minette Battle of Westport Fund. It's devoted to preserving the battlefield here, right here in Kansas City. Well, you just mentioned that he didn't get the rallying effect that he had hoped for as this army swept westward from central Missouri. Let's make no mistake here. These were not even Stephen armies in terms of strength of number of troops. The North had a huge advantage, right?
No, it did not. It was quite to the contrary.
Really?
To get to not too far off page here, but for those that are military historians, they know about the Battle of Austerlitz with Napoleon in 1806, in which Napoleon faced off against two opposing armies, the Prussians and the Austrians, and they were divided. And so the idea from a Napoleonic tactic was you attack one enemy, one army first, and then you turn and face the other one and destroy them. And so Price's tactic in this matter was not particularly off the boards. It was a sound military tactic. He had 12,000 soldiers, and Samuel Curtis, commanding here at Kansas City for the Federals, had only 4,000 effectives, and they were scattered from here out across Kansas, guarding the Santa Fe Trail and fighting with Indians. So in terms of the fight, it was very uneven, actually in favor of Sterling Price.
Well, initially.
Yes. And then we have a second federal force that is pursuing Price across Missouri from St. Louis with another 4,000 troops. And they have come far. They have started out from Memphis, Tennessee, and they've gone through the brambles of northeast Arkansas and are really torn up. And eventually the federal force, it gets back to Cape Girardeau, gets on boats, and gets refitted to pursue Price across Missouri. So the idea that, oh, gee, the poor old Sterling Price had no chance here is not accurate. He had a opportunity to actually be successful.
But he wasn't.
Right. And the reason being is that time got away from him.
In what sense?
Well, one of the things that happened that kind of seals the deal on this is the action at the Little Blue east of Independence on 21 October, in which the forces of Price are arrayed against a relatively small 3,500 force of General Blunt in from the Kansans to retard his advance towards Kansas City.
Hey, let me just talk about this for a moment, because the sites of these battles in Kansas City are well known to almost everybody. We're talking Swope Park, we're talking Brush Creek, we're talking Westport, we're talking Loose Park, we're talking the Warnell House a little further out south on Warnell Road. I mean, we're talking about places that people are going to recognize here.
That's correct, because this battle didn't happen just one location. It happened over about 35
yes.
square miles of Kansas City.
Yeah, and it ranges back and forth. Right,
correct.
So what happens?
Well, it's a little
on that first day. Yeah.
On the Little Blue battle, what happens is there are about 8,000 to 9,000 Confederates engaged with a 3,500, much smaller, federal force. The difference there is that the federal forces have repeating weapons, which they have the top of the line, not usual, and they are not government issue, but General Blunt had required that the his troops be supplied by whatever hook or by crook with repeating guns. And so this smaller force, the 3,500 Federals, kept the advancing Confederates at bay for the entire day. So they start from sunup at 5 in the morning, and until 5 that night, they finally reach Independence, a distance of 5 miles. That distance, that delay in making their advance into Independence costs the Confederates precious time, as finally the Federal forces under Pleasonton, who were coming from the east from St. Louis, gives them time to catch up.
So they catch up coming from behind.
Correct.
And the northern troops are still, there's some amassing here in the Kansas
right.
City area.
Right.
Okay, so they're coming at them from two directions in
correct.
A sense.
And Curtis's strategy as a federal commander and engineer, a West Point graduate, is that he was going to make a defensive line along the west bank of the Big Blue. And that's what he did. He sent the militia troops from Kansas out to basically do grunt work of felling trees and causing the obstruction to the advance of the federal Confederate.
And this
forces.
Is where exactly, Dan?
It runs from the Hawthorne plant on the Missouri River
mm-hmm.
south for about 9 miles down to Hickman Mills, which is roughly where the 71 Highway now crosses the Big Blue.
So we're talking right down Brush Creek.
Right down Big Blue, not
okay.
Brush Creek.
Okay, Big Blue. Okay, I got you.
And that's the initial defensive line that Curtis has decided to try to retard them from making their advance. And it's a successful one, except for the fact that eventually Joe Shelby, the greatest cavalry commander of the Confederates, is able to make a breakthrough at Byram's Ford on the late morning, early afternoon of the 22nd. And then this wagon train of 5 miles long of the Price's Army stretched out from the basically where the ballpark is back to the Rock Creek Country Club is able to pass through. From a logistics standpoint, it's remarkable that this wagon train got through. And one of the reasons why it was so important was that Mom and the kids and Sally, Aunt Sally, were all on board with this. It wasn't just a military convoy. It was actually Mom and the kids were leaving central Missouri because Order No. 11 and everything had turned hostile mm-hmm. to their continued remaining here. Because up to this point in time, the pattern had been that the Confederates would fight during the spring through the fall, and then they'd go home and spend the winter there.
Huh.
Well, this time they were going to leave, and they went to Texas. In fact, we have a family that by the name of Ben Rice that lived at the Byram's Ford site.
Right.
And all the children on the census are born in Missouri except those that set the one child was born in 1865, which was born in Texas.
Yeah. We're talking about the Battle of Westport. Dan Smith is here talking to us about this. Hey, give us a sense. And, you know, the border war had been raging here for any number of years, a decade maybe or more at that point, or coming close to that, Dan. What was the atmosphere in Kansas City at that time, at the time of the Battle of Westport?
At that time, there was a continued insurgency by the Confederates in the form of Quantrill and his successor, Todd. And there was upset that way. But generally what had happened was, and what we find during the battle, is that the folks at the Byram's Ford plus other areas around the county had been removed and were living in either Kansas somewhere or they were in remote areas of Missouri. So that you would be going into this area as a Confederate into sort of a place where a nuclear bomb, a neutron-type bomb had gone off. It didn't destroy buildings, but all the people were gone.
Yeah.
And so it was a very peculiar situation that way.
Hmm. Okay, so let's walk through day two and then day three. You set the scene for day one. What happens day two?
Day two is where the action happens at Byram's Ford principally, which is just north of Swope Park today
mm-hmm.
off of 63rd Street, which is our principal focus for preservation and restoration. And what happens there is that the forces under the Confederates with this long wagon train are desperate to get across the defensive line that Curtis has established on the Blue. And they attack there, and they're unsuccessful, and a small number of Federals under Doc Jennison, the noted Jayhawker from Kansas, is defending that position. And until they get flanked by movements downstream and upstream, they are impregnable. But they eventually are outflanked by the Confederates, and then they have to withdraw back to Westport. As a result of that breakthrough by Shelby's forces, then the Confederates then swarm out across what's now southern Kansas City past what would be Waldo. And the Waldo area then becomes the encampment on the evening of the 22nd for the Confederates.
And there's a sense here that the Confederates now have the upper hand, right?
Absolutely, because there is really no effective force defending against their moving right in across the state line into Kansas. It was really a very dicey situation from the federal perspective.
But the Federals managed to turn the tide going into day three, and on day three, what happens there, Dan?
What happens is we have a two-front battle going on. It's two different theaters. And when we talk about this, you can think of, in the analogy to Gettysburg, we have the little action, little round top, which is on the south end of the line, and then we have Pickett's charge going up on the north end of the line. And so we have separate actions going on at the two different locations, but it's all one part of one big battle. What happens on the 23rd is that Jennison, who had been at Byram's Fort, then is moved over to the Brush Creek location, and he begins the action at Brush Creek. The folks at Byram's Fort then have flipped. The Confederates are now defending that position on the west bank, and the federal forces from Independence under Pleasanton, this pursuing unit from the east, are catching up, and they engage at the sunlight. And they Pleasanton, who was a cavalry commander at Gettysburg the year before but didn't get along with his superiors, sent here to Missouri, and he is very aggressive in pushing forward the attack at Byram's Fort. But because of their position, the Confederates enjoyed a significant ability to hold that position, and it could have continued to do so, except for the fact of one issue.
So the North turns the tide. They grab the reins here.
The two federal forces finally are able to converge, and that forces the breakthrough at the collapse of the Confederate line at Byram's Fort at 11 o'clock on the morning of the 23rd, results in exposure of the right flank of the Confederates in Brush Creek, which then forces them to also withdraw. And that's why the Confederates are eventually forced from the field.
What do inhabitants of Kansas City in those days, residents, what did they say about just how fierce the fighting was here in Kansas City during those 3 days, Dan?
It varies. We have an account by a member of the 2nd Colorado Cavalry, which charged on the 23rd along Warnell Road, who says that there were dead bodies for a half mile from basically where opposite Loose Park up towards the Warnell House. Mm-hmm. Then we have a fellow who was a minister, and he says, well, I went out and I didn't see much. But that's because they were back in Kansas City behind the entrenchments about 20th Street because they were afraid that Kansas City was going to be overwhelmed.
Yeah. What would have happened if the Confederates had seized the advantage on day two and then maintained it going into day three and won the Battle of Westport? What would that have meant for Missouri and the future of our state?
Well, I think the more immediate thing was that, and that's kind of answering your question in reverse. What happened, because the Federals won in Westport, there was an immediate adoption of the Emancipation Ordinance in Missouri 60 days later. And the
Emancipation Proclamation you're talking about?
Well, not the Emancipation Proclamation. That's Lincoln. But this is the state ordinance was adopted because the Emancipation Proclamation did not free slaves that were in states that were still loyal to the Union, which was the category that Missouri fell into.
Mm-hmm.
But the Emancipation Ordinance was adopted in Missouri on January 1, 1865, as a outcrop or as a result of the success at Westport.
You know, the Union forces, they pursue the Confederates out of Kansas City, going south back into Arkansas. Why didn't they catch them, and what would have happened if they had?
Well, My beginning with Civil War starts with the Battle of Mine Creek just south of Pleasanton, where I grew up. And at Mine Creek, the Confederates did lose significantly. The same forces that had been engaged at Byram's Ford 2 days earlier on the 23rd are reengaged on the 25th. The same forces, same personnel. This time, the formation doesn't favor them, and the Confederates are caught up unawares. They lose approximately two-thirds of their army at that point.
Yeah.
And so they are effectively destroyed as a fighting force, because Price's army, even though it doesn't hold the ground at the end of the day on 23rd, is still a force that has 12,000 men, and they're still able to be a fighting force. It's at Mine Creek where the final denouement, if you will, of the Missouri expedition takes place, because shortly after their defeat, Price has to abandon the wagon train and blows it up a few miles east of Fort Scott.
So if you could have been in one place and maybe witnessed 1 hour of this three-day fight, the Battle of Westport, where would you like to have been? What would you like to have seen with your own eyes to see how the thing unfolded, maybe the pivotal moment, Dan, of these 3 days?
Well, I think probably one of the most interesting aspects of it is the conflict along the Warner Road. Even though this battle is all cavalry, most of it was done by dismounted troops. In other words, they ride up to a place with their horses, and then they dismount, and one fellow of their four will hold the horses while the other three go out and skirmish with their enemy. We have actual cavalry-type things that we think of happening along the Warner Lane area, in the area around where Loose Park is. And all of that was, quite contrary to today, was an open plain. It was an open pasture. And these fellows are going at each other hot and heavy, firing.
It's spilling over to Loose Park, obviously.
Yes. Loose Park is part of the Brush Creek where Shelby ends up on the Sunday, the 23rd, on the last day of the battle.
Mm-hmm.
And they're engaged in one-on-one combat. Rather than being far apart, they're up close and personal.
Tell us a little bit, just briefly, about efforts to preserve battlefields and what's going to be commemorated this year on the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Westport, Dan.
We had presented our Saving Kansas City's Battlefield Initiative starting back in 2006 with the purpose of restoring the battlefield at Byron's Ford site, which is on the Blue River just north of Swope Park. This is a site of a 1960s industrial warehouse park, and it's in decline. And so a number of the buildings have been acquired by us and are in the process of being removed. We are now in the process of raising $150,000 to remove one of the buildings in the center of the field so we can proceed.
Dan, I want to thank you for your time today. We have to leave a little bit earlier than I thought to join a presidential news conference beginning in just a couple of minutes. Thanks for your time. So good to have you
here. Thank you again so much.
So interesting. Yeah,
thank
appreciate
you.
It. That's Dan Smith. He's an attorney at Anchor Holtz & Smith. He's chairman of the Minette Battle of Westport Fund. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you've been listening to Up to Date on KCUR.